Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Breaking News Journal on Air Radio. What you just heard is a tribute to Larry Graswell. He was a military man who served our country, and he's the one that alerted America to who the Weather Underground was and what they were trying to do to destroy our country. And so we are going to be doing a tribute to him, and I want to you guys to know that that's the music that we're going to play in the video tribute that we're going to have for him. Today we have a special guest, another military guy who I've just found out about, Mr. John Bernard, and he's a wonderful person. He has taken his military experience and became a businessman, and we're going to talk to you about his business, woodworking. And I always get it wrong, but he's going to give me corrected. Mr. Bernard, are you there?
Yes, I am, Ruth. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Actually, you know, I'm kind of hurting for my brother that passed away last week. I'm sure you might know who he is. Have you ever heard of Larry Graswell?
In passing, yes, but unfortunately, no, I don't know a great deal about him.
He was an FBI informant who brought down the Weather Underground when they were trying to exterminate over 50 million people of American citizens. They were radical people that were operating in the 60s and 70s, and he infiltrated them and exposed who they were, and it brought them down, and some of them went to prison and so on and so forth. He passed away last week. And
I'm very sorry to hear that. And yeah, it's tough when you see guys that are on the line and trying to do the right thing, and you know, whether it's by natural causes or other means, it's sad to see them go.
Yeah, it is. It's very sad. And, you know, everybody that didn't know him will get a chance to find out about him. I'll get the video over to you once we complete it and stuff. I'll get it out to all of our people. But I just wanted to give that little tribute to him. Everybody's been writing articles about him all week long and stuff like that, and his funeral was yesterday. So anyway, Mr. Bernard, on a happier note, you know, you are a Marine, a military guy, and we just honor you and the work that you did for us and our country, and now you're a businessman, and that's why I wanted to have you on Breaking News Journal on air. We really like to expose grassroots business people and people that are doing something important for our country, and I'd like to talk to you about your story. So, I'm going to give it over to you so you can tell us, you know, what you did, how you learned your trade, and what you did in the military, and so on.
Sure. That's a large menu. I'll see if I can break it down here. I started in the shop with my father at the age of 8, and some folks might think that's not very meaningful, but in another time, in another era, maybe in another universe, that was very meaningful. For those who were born, let's say, after 1970, a lot of this will be lost on you, so maybe you'll understand. After I get through, hopefully I can make you understand. But there was a time in history when, if your father was in the trade or in a trade, it was pretty natural for your father to then, at some point, take you with him and teach you what he knew. There was no suggestion or even expectation that you would necessarily follow in your father's footsteps. But at the very least, your father took you with him, and you had a greater appreciation of the trade that he was in, and certainly a better appreciation of your father as a worker, as a father, and in a completely different environment. And my father was no different. Like I said, when I was 8, and it was safe enough to take me around where he didn't have to explain to me that you shouldn't stick your hand into a table saw, then I was on site with him. And I had a great time you know, in the trade, so much so that I actually took a great liking to it. And if you were to talk to my father or anybody that was around, they would tell you that I displayed a gift in the trade early on. And,
wow.
You know, the other thing that's unique about that is that, not really, it's unique now, it wasn't unique then, was that when you showed a specific talent or gift for something, some predilection for something, people would let you know, and they would foster that. They would let you know, look, you're doing pretty well at that. You seem to have a gift for that, and they would encourage you, and then you would feel, you know, better about it, and you would continue. And it wasn't a question of building somebody's ego; it was a question of letting them know that you recognized something in them. And you know, young kids don't really know. I mean, they don't have any direction until people help them that way, and so. You know, being told that I had some sort of natural gift for that sort of encouraged me to continue on with it. And the more I showed an interest, the more my father gave me. And so I stayed with the trade until I went into the Marine Corps at the age of 18 in 1972. So people can do the math.
Yeah.
But,
that's the year I graduated. I graduated the year after you went into the military. I graduated from high school then.
In 73, did you?
Yes.
Very good. Good for you. Yeah, it was really a tough time actually to join the service. But I guess I kind of need to fill that out too. I when I joined in 72, that wasn't, you know, one of these things where you know, at the last minute, you know, you're looking at graduation in the face and you're not sure about college or about work or whatever, and I decided for the service. My entire life, if there was anything else that anybody would tell you, is that for all of the years that they ever knew me, my parents told me from the age of 3, I had said that I wanted to be a Marine. Yeah, age of 3, people don't know what they really want, but I said that, and I never deterred from that. And,
and
my entire life, really, I was crafted around this idea of, you know, finishing school, dealing with family, learning the trade because I liked it, but ultimately, casting all that aside, to join the United States Marine Corps in 1972. That was my intent, and that's what I did. And, and even more 72, because those were the waning years of Vietnam, and I was very much troubled by the tenor in the country towards our fighting men, and it bothered me. I mean, right to the depths of my being, and I being as I couldn't seem to convince anybody of my age group, or not enough anyway, or anyone to be more invested in what was happening and be more invested in the lives of those guys. It got to the point where it became an obsession, really, to join in as quickly as possible, so that I could live with and even die with, you know, the guys that that I'd come to revere. And,
well, you know, I didn't realize myself until many years later how they were treated. I'm from Colorado, and you know, we didn't. All I can remember as a child is that there were no young men on the streets, you know, and when I would see a military person, I always respected them and loved them, and that's what we did in Colorado. However, a lot of the mood seemed to be in California, people keeping an eye on the media, keeping an eye on California and all the radical things that were going on across the country during the 70s, and that was not the whole story, but it seemed like it just picked up a lot of speed and people started mistreating them. How are you going to mistreat the people who served our country because they were trying to protect us instead of the people that you need to get upset with? And that's the people that were putting you in the line of fire or whatever, people like you in the line of fire that didn't have our best interests at heart. Those are the people they should have been spitting on and things like that, not you guys.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and I really wish I had been born a few years earlier so that I could have been thrust into the middle of that, so that I could have shared the misery that those guys suffered. You and I joined at a time, you know, where they really weren't sending anybody. Remember, President Nixon had made a decision that nobody would be shipped. I think it was in like January of 73. I was actually in boot camp August of 72, but the word had already gone out that was imminent. And I remember looking down the squad bay as best I could without getting caught. But when the drill instructor came down and said, all you warmongers that were planning on going to Vietnam and kill people, you're gonna be upset because the president's already announced that they're not going to send any more. And the official word didn't come down until January, but we got it as early as August. And I remember seeing 70-some-odd shoulders just slump. Realization that they had joined specifically to go serve in a combat zone, and now they weren't going to do that. And so you and I, in that era, we joined. Excuse me, it was still the Vietnam era. Vietnam, I remember, for those that don't remember, the Saigon didn't fall until 1975. That was the very last operation of the war, which actually I write about in my blog. It really didn't happen until 1975. So we had those 3 years to kind of languish, you know, in the service, knowing that we were that close, but we were just born a little too late. I mean, I joined at 17. And so it was a very, very tough time, and it remained tough for me in the service, a hard thing to live with until I finally deployed to the Gulf in 1990. And
you know what? You're a Marine. Our son is a Marine, too, and he was in the Gulf War. You know, isn't that funny?
Yeah, it is. It is indeed. And I would love to meet him someday and find out who he was with and all of that.
Okay.
The thing with the Gulf War was unique in the sense that, you know, the United States really beat itself into the ground over Vietnam. Vietnam failed for a whole battery of reasons, not the least of which was political vision. It was probably the third instance of the attempt to fight a war within the paradigm of counterinsurgency doctrine, and all other elements or all other attempts at that up to that point had failed one way or the other. Some people declare that the experience with the Brits in Malay from 48 to 1960 was successful, but the reality is by the end of that campaign, the Brits ended up having to give over Malay, the control of Malay, to the Malay people. That was a protectorate, if you will, that the Brits controlled for 135 years.
Wow.
And because the Chinese came down, crossed the Thai border, and went into Malay with the intention of subverting that government and turning it into a communist nation. The Brits had to fight that. It was a very unpopular war. It took 12 years to root out the truly insurgent insurgents.
Wow.
Not like what we're fighting in these current wars. These folks,
right,
literally from there, they were from somewhere else, and they really weren't wanted. And it took a long time to root them up. Well, by 1960, between the cost of World War II and the cost of Korea, and then the cost of this fight in Malay, the Brits literally had to give up control of Malay. Then you
wow.
had the French, which had to give up Vietnam in 1953-54. Dien Bien Phu, we took over, and ultimately we ended up giving it back in 1975. Mm-hmm. In 1975, as we all know, the North Vietnamese actually swarmed through South Vietnam and took it over. So there were three incredibly horrible losses, all based on the exact same wrong-headed vision. And all those years later, we really didn't have a chance to sort of prove that we were still a nation to deal with until the Gulf War. And so once we went to the Gulf, there were two things that happened. Number one, there was a major concern that we would see chemical warfare, and then secondarily, that it would be an opportunity really for us to sort of to shine again as a militaristic nation.
I remember that, and that a lot of people a lot of people did get Agent Orange.
Oh, in Vietnam, absolutely, yes. And yeah, there. Look, every single war has produced something that has been deadly for the troops. Everything has. I mean, aside from warfare itself.
Yeah.
So you had, we had in World War One, we had mustard gas. A lot of guys came, were absolutely destroyed. You had guys that came back with malnutrition and every conceivable form of malady in the Civil War. World War II, I don't know if there's anything you can name that they didn't come back suffering from, including first really dedicated, understood elements of post-traumatic stress syndrome. Same thing in Korea. Vietnam, it was Agent Orange and PTSD, ratcheted forward to the Gulf. And there was some suggestion that sarin gas had been released, and some of the guys, in fact, in areas that I walked through, is believed that they were affected by sarin gas. I fortunately wasn't affected in any way at all, but the guys in my unit have had these very mysterious illnesses that they just have never been able to shake since.
Wow.
And so you've got all of this, and I stayed till 2003, well into this current. With this current war, with this current enemy, and was forced to retire. And that sounds bad. The bottom line is that for those of us in the Marine Corps, we understand there is a combination of time and grade, and if you're not smart enough to leave, the Marine Corps will explain to you that, look, it's been fun, it's been real, time to go home, you know? So 2003,
yeah.
I stayed till I always said I would stay until they kicked me out, and so 2003, they said, look, it's annoying, but you got to go home. So.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Well, see, that background information is a lot. You have a lot more. You've explained a lot more to me in 15 minutes than I really realized that it happened throughout all of our years of fighting in different wars. And this is important for people to know. And I wanted people to know today about you because, you transferred that with all those experiences back into the business of your childhood. And a lot of people that get out of the military, they have this PTSD, and all of a sudden, they can't do anything, or they're looking for jobs and stuff like that. I wanted to see people start their own businesses so they don't have to rely on the government the way that they have. I used to work for the Veterans Administration in West Los Angeles and Westwood area, and I also used to work for the United States Air Force in the Accounting and Finance Center. So, and I hated working there because I did not like to see our men and women being mistreated. And they would come into the Veterans Administration, and they would sit there for hours upon hours at a time. And the military guys that worked there, they did the best that they could. But then the bureaucracy would say, they would have fouls on these people, whether they would even be able to get treatment. I could not take it. I worked there for 3 years, and I left after 1981. I could not take any more of the military being misused when they have served our country and they have stood in the gap for us and protecting us, and this is the kind of service that they get when they get out. I just couldn't take it.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's just an extension of you know, the mentality that was floating around in the latter part of the 60s and the early 70s. It's just incredible to me. Yeah, people don't understand. You know, when a guy joins the service, and this isn't me pleading for me or me even pleading for you. This is pleading for the guys that come out that are, you know, as a community. They come off active duty, whether it's from, you know, two, three, or four deployments to, you know, to a war zone. Or maybe, you know, in some instances, even today, you get some people that haven't really deployed to a war zone. It doesn't make any difference. You know, the decision to go to a war zone is not personal. When you join the service, you are directed where you're going to go. And
wow.
And the thing people need to understand, once you sign that line and you swear that oath, there are like a couple of things that happen. Not only are you going to be held to the finer points of that oath, but, you know, without actually stating as such, what you do is you voluntarily suspend your constitutional rights as an American. And you
wow.
give over not only your ability to speak, which you can't speak openly about political things, for instance, as long
mm-hmm.
as you're in
mm-hmm.
uniform. Mm-hmm. You can't say things that are detrimental to the services, detrimental to anybody in the political sphere. Detrimental, I mean, you know, in terms of you know,
mm-hmm.
how it might affect aim. Not, obviously, you can't do anything physically anyway. But in addition to that, you give over, basically, your very right to life into the hands of the political structure that's in place at the time. And you say, basically, look, I am yours. You can place me where you feel. Place me in harm's way. I am prepared to do whatever is necessary to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign or domestic.
Foreign and domestic, yes.
And do it the way that you see fit. I give over to you my life. I've tried to explain this in a way that people might understand. Those that are very passionate about the abortion issue, what I tell them is this. There have been some 40 or 50 million babies aborted, and I'm going to tell you right now that sin is not as great as the sin politicians commit against war fighters when they knowingly send them into harm's way, knowing that they are sending them there with less than what they need, or when they bring them back and then abandon them. And the reason that's
mm-hmm.
worse is because they can look into the eyes of the individual that they are abusing and killing. When an argument can be made for abortion that you don't know, you know, some people don't know, they haven't accepted or didn't understand that it, in fact, was
mm-hmm.
a life. They didn't
mm-hmm.
see it.
Mm-hmm.
You can see a 17, 18, and 19-year-old kid, and you can understand what's going to happen to that kid once he takes a bullet and he's dead, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so it the greatest travesty, regardless of what the left and anybody else wants to say, the greatest travesty
mm-hmm.
on any particular community of individuals in this country is to the war fighters. If we leave them, we let them come back, and we let them flounder for work, we let them flounder for their health, mental or physical, shame on us. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is one group of individuals who have willingly given themselves over to the country, and when you come back, you would think that the country would then take them up in their arms and make sure that they're okay.
Exactly. What do you think about, you're absolutely right. That's the way I feel we should be operating all the time, because your hearts are in it when you volunteer to serve our country. What do you say about the mood of people who want to get into the military right now, since all of their rights are gone when they sign that piece of paper? What do you think about under the current administration and the way they're treating our military now? Would you recommend that a person not volunteer, or how would you see that? What would be your advice to them?
Yeah, well, I see this as two completely different paradigms. Number one, you've got the political sphere that, you know, it's become obvious at this point that none of us apparently can control. So we
mm-hmm.
go to the voting, cast our vote with a whole bunch of other people. You and I probably would vote for almost the same individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, your vote, my vote, and probably another couple million other folks that are voting the same way, in the end, even if we get the guy we want, you know, it's not necessarily saying that they represent us in totality. They represent the least of the worst is what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we turn around and we make decisions to vote for folks Not so much based on, look, I really, really, really can get behind this guy because this guy absolutely represents everything that I believe in. We look at it and say, that guy's not as bad as the other guy, you know? And we end up...
Lesser of two evils. You're talking about the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, and we're stuck with that. So that's one paradigm. The second thing is where the individual sits within his own life. And you know something, an 18-year-old kid, typically, if they're at all functioning from the neck up, and their heart is enjoined with their head, they've got some sense, there's this sort of burning desire to do something. Unless they've been sitting on the sidelines and nobody has mentored them and nobody's encouraged them, those kids that have been encouraged and mentored have this intense sense that they need to do something. Some of those kids have this intense sense that they need to serve in a uniform. Many of them, like me, know specifically what uniform, not only what uniform, but which part of the Marine Corps they need to be in. You know, they need to encourage.
Oh, you just said something I never heard of before, that what part of the Marines they need to be in. Could you please clarify that? I don't understand.
Oh, absolutely. Look, in 1972, I have to draw on my own experience to some degree, but I'm going to talk to you about my son in a second, too. But, in 1972, you know, when I joined, I knew years before what part of the Marine Corps I wanted to be in. Look, you could be a firefighter, as we like to say in the service, you could be a cook, baker, or candlestick maker, you know, in the service. Or you could be a grunt. You could be ground infantry. I could have been almost anything. I could have gone to college, come out, been an officer, and then gone in, you know. I could have signed for the MESEP program and become an officer midway through my enlistment. My heart was with the enlisted man as an infantryman, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I did. And so I sought out. When I joined, remember, there was a draft. I was supposed to not only eligible for the draft, I was supposed to sign for the draft, which I never did. Instead, at 17, I walked to my recruiting office, walked in, and he tried to sell me a whole bunch of stuff. They gave me the ASVAB. He says, look, you're qualified for anything you want to do. I said, good, I want 4 years as a grunt. And he was shocked because there was a war going on that was unpopular. Guys were getting killed, you know. And they had a fight for every single guy they got to sign. I walked in, and I wanted, from certain vantage points, the worst of the worst, you know.
Oh, wow.
From my vantage point, that was where my heart was. That was what I was designed to be, a grunt. You know, and I wanted to do that, and I wanted to be, whether it meant swimming in blood or swimming in mud, I wanted to be with the people who were like-minded, and I wanted to be there, and I wanted to experience and to suffer with those men, you know, at that point in my life. I needed that, you know, and I wanted to serve. The rest of it was almost incidental. Once I could get in that uniform, all of the nonsense that was going out in the streets and what the media was talking about and the kumbaya things and the rest of that nonsense... Oh, that was done. All I needed to do was be surrounded by men who wanted to be that. And there are people today, there are kids today in schools who have this innate sense that they need to do that, you know. And what I will tell you, to answer that part of that question for you, we need to not make sure that we are absolutely 100% supportive of that and encouraging them to go and serve. No matter what the political sphere does to them, that is the sin of the politician.
Okay.
It would be a crime and a sin for us to tell these kids who were built, who were designed, who were gifted by God to go out and do this, don't do this because it's the wrong time. This is their time. They do it now or they never do it. So they need to go do it because ultimately they're going to serve with like-minded people. They're not going to serve the politicians. They're going to serve with fellow Marines, soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Coast Guardsmen.
Wow. You really made that really plain to me. So I'm really glad that you made that statement because I really was wrestling with how to tell somebody, that a young person, you know, whether they should go into the military or not. And I was leaning the other way. So I really am glad that you said that. I don't want to switch gears, but I do want to talk about your business. And I want you to give information to your business and the kind of things you have, because I've looked at your website. You do some wonderful work, and I'd like to talk to you about that and your business, your businesses that you've worked with and stuff like that, and how people can get your services.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, first of all, they can go to my website. It's www.bernardwoodworking.com. It's all one word, all lowercase. Bernard, just like the dog or the saint, B-E-R-N-A-R-D, woodworking.com. And from there, if they navigate through the site, they will find, you can't fill your website with every single project that you've ever done. So we try to, it becomes impossible. For instance, there's one.
I can imagine.
Well, we've done over 20 banks with Bangor Savings Bank in Maine. We've done their main office, which is separate. We've done a myriad of things just with that one customer. You can't show all of that. We've built five timber frames residentially. There's one timber frame that I think there's two on there now I think about it, that we actually show some of the photographs for. We do kitchens. But largely what we do, if somebody said, look, if there was one element of the trade that you wanted to stay with, what would it be? Oh, by the way, we design, too. I mean, we have full CAD services. We design a lot of the stuff that we do. So we take it from design right through to construction, the last nail, the last bit of paint. The thing is that if somebody said, look, what is it, you know, where's your heart really at, what would you do? It would be in three areas. It would be either kitchens, commercial millwork, or timber frames. And we would do one of those three things. But the reality is we've done just about everything under the sun in the woodworking trade. And I like to leave it that way. I keep telling people, if you're not diverse in your trade, then you haven't studied hard enough in your trade. Because when I grew up, a carpenter wasn't a trim guy or a framer or a roofer or a foundation guy or a door guy or a window guy or a siding guy or whatever. You did all of those things. And
It's almost like the same thing of a doctor. Doctors in our day were doctors who did everything. You know, now they've got doctors that are foot doctors, ear doctors, throat doctors, the same kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's, if you wanted to put a phrase on it, it's all about specialization. And the problem is that while that would seem to suggest that an individual in a very, very narrowly defined section of any given trade, whether it's you know, medicine or wood or whatever, it would suggest that he would then become, you know, incredibly well-versed in that trade. But what happens is when you dumb down things and you make the you basically pull apart a trade and you start separating the finer elements of those trades, what ends up happening is you teach people, you train people to only think about portions of the trade, and they never really think any further than that. So anybody comes into my trade, if I hire anybody, they understand coming into the door, look, I don't expect you to know everything, but you better know the machines, and you better be number two, absolutely willing to learn all of it, because if you're not, I don't need
you. Wow. So, I love your way of thinking. You're absolutely right about that. Do you hire, like, military servicemen? Do they know how to get in touch with you if they need, if there's a spot in your heart or in your business for people that are in the military when they get out and they need to learn a trade or they want to get involved in the trade that you have or anything like that? Do you do anything like that?
Yeah, I'm going to break it down in three levels. Number one, my first concern is that the person that walks through the door isn't saying, look, I'm a warm body looking for a job.
Amen.
The person walking has to say, look, I'm not only a warm body looking for a job, but I've always wanted to be in this trade. I know this is the trade I'm supposed to be in. Maybe
yeah.
I worked with my cousin or what, but this I've always had my heart in this trade. That's number one.
Yeah.
Then next two people I'm looking for, you know, preferably, I don't say no to anybody, but the next two people I'm looking for, yeah, would be guys that have spent time in uniform. They get my ear. My ear's wide open. Simple as that. And then the third are folks that are in the church. You know. So
it's
those three areas that I'm interested in. But primarily, it's got to be somebody that's absolutely interested, that they know he belongs in the trade. He's not just like a job is a job is a job. Well, if that's the case, then go down the street, because this isn't just a job, you know. This here
absolutely.
Is a career.
Absolutely.
You define the trade. So you come into me and you tell me I'm supposed to give you something that's going to define you? You got it backwards, you know. You define the trade. And the thing is, once they walk out, hopefully they're enriched from the experience. I act kind of like a first sergeant, but if you talk to any people who have worked for me, they don't feel like they've ever been beaten up. In fact, they feel very, very good about the whole environment because it's my family as far as I'm concerned. So we go out and we go to job sites sometimes and we work around the clock, sleep on the floor of the job site. The point is, at that point, all that's important is making the job. Look, we walk away from a job, we talk about zero punch list. I don't ever want a customer coming up to me or any of my people and saying, look, something isn't done. You know, I want to be able to go to them. When I say it's done, I need to know that when they walk around and look, they can't find anything, you know.
Wow.
And so that's the way it is, and in general, that's the way it's been.
Wow. So do you guys since my team of Breaking News Journal, we're in the process of getting ready to start a TV channel. So if we needed like your business to build media sets or movie sets or TV sets or anything like that, do you guys do those kind of things as well?
Oh, absolutely. The thing is, you know, I've had people, it's funny, if you could just bear with me for a second. Years ago, I wanted to break into building. I wanted to build a house. We were doing a lot of remodeling, but it's a curious trade. The trade is very, very curious in the sense that, once you're in something, people assume that's all you can do. And when they look at it, they don't see how that translates into something else. And because society's been sort of wired to believe that, you know, a guy that hangs doors can't do roofing, a guy that does roofing can't frame, and a guy that's framing can't do his house, then they just automatically assume those things. So they don't look at, for instance, if you do an addition, they don't see that as a smaller version of a house. They see it as an addition and something, well, that's less than. So, you know, I remember trying to break in and trying to convince people that I could build a house was difficult. When I finally did it, the very first house we built was 8,000 square feet.
Woo!
And it had elements in that building, design elements, that we will never, ever see again. I built that house. We built probably four or five houses after that. And then I remember a customer came to me directly and said, look, we got a house that's not really big, you know, so we'd like to build this. I said, okay, well, let me show you what we've done. So I showed her all of these things that we had done, these massive structures, 8,000, 5,600, 6,000, you know, and said, look, this is what we've done. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. She said, yeah, but I need to know that you can build something smaller. So I actually didn't have an answer for her. I was actually flabbergasted. And I said, I'm not really sure how to answer that. We do everything from additions to full houses. If we can build an addition and we can build an 8,000 square foot architectural design, I think we can handle your house, you know? But she just wasn't.
That was funny.
So it was, anyway. And then I remember the next big thing, because I had actually started in the shop wanting to be able to then do all, not only the trim in the house, but I wanted to be able to market and to build kitchen cabinetry and, you know, all of the casework in a house. Well, you're a framer. You really can't. I said, no, I'm not a framer. I'm a builder. Actually, I'm a carpenter. And if you come right down to it, by trade, I'm a cabinet maker. Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't make them understand that because you were building houses, you know. You know, somebody builds a house, can't build cabinets. But if you look at my website, obviously we can do all of it, you know.
Yes, so, and now absolutely. That's what
you
I saw.
Always have this tension, you know, between folks thinking that the trade has to be exploded like that and you're only good in certain elements of the trade. But the reality is it's not that way. So to answer your question.
And I agree.
You want to do sets. We sit down. You're working with an architect. The architect works with us, tells us what he wants. We retranslate his work in shop drawings. Or you come to me and say, look, we don't even have that. Can you design it? Then we design it.
Okay, that sounds good to me. So we will definitely be keeping you in mind because we should be doing a lot of work across the country. So where are you located? I know you're at www.bernardwoodworking.com, and that's B-E-R, people, N-A-R-D. I had so much trouble putting Mr. Bernard's name on everything because I'm used to Bernard being spelled so many different ways that I couldn't really – I was like seeing one thing and putting up something else, and that's the kind of thing was going on. But it's www.bernard, B-E-R-N-A-R-D, woodworking.com. And I hope all of you guys use his services and his business. I mean, he is a true American and a true Marine. Is there anything else you want to say before we close the program?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to let folks know that the cost associated with warfighting, with being in the service in a uniform, for most of us, sometimes extends even deeper than we would hope for. So I've got a myriad of people in my family that have been in the Marine Corps. My father, a cousin, four nephews. I've got a sister, her brother-in-law.
Wow.
Sister, her brother-in-law. One of my sisters was in the Air Force. She's the only one, because I beat on her mercilessly for joining the Air Force. But I've got extended family, including my son, who joined in 2000 and December 2006, and was consequently killed in Afghanistan in August 2009, and in Nowzad, Afghanistan. That young man, and you'll see mention of him on that website, and you'll also find a link for my blog, www.letthemfight.blogspot.com, and I would ask folks to please pay attention to that as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mr. Bernard, it has been a pleasure having you on, and I will have you on Breaking News Journal on Air Radio again. It was just an honor and a pleasure having you on with us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks a lot, Ruth. It was really great, and I deeply appreciate your asking, and it was really, really great talking to you.
You're more than welcome. Have a good, great day now.
Yes, ma'am. You too.
Come rain, come shine, I meet you, and to me the world is fine. Then I kiss your lips, and the pounding becomes the ocean's roar. When you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed to tell you that you're marvelous, tell you that you're wonderful again, 'cause I've got you under my skin, and I love you under my skin.